You're listening to The Exchange. Here's today's show.
Thank you, Dom. Welcome to The Exchange, everybody. Here's what's ahead. Markets are taking the spread of COVID in stride as the tech trade storms higher again today. Amazon crossing 3,000 a share. The Nasdaq 100 is up 20% on the year. Are there opportunities still left? We do have some names. Plus, Becton Dickinson gets FDA approval for a new 15-minute portable COVID test. We're going to speak with the CEO about this technology and how they plan to meet demand as cases rise across the country. And Uber mates with Postmates, sports teams race to change their names. Tesla soars and Elon Musk goes shorts. It's all ahead in rapid fire today. We begin with the rally. Bob Pisani here to walk us through it. Bob?
And Kelly, we are up, but not like we were earlier today. Once again, the market is relying on mega caps, tech, work from home to essentially power the market forward. It is indeed doing that, but at the cost of a few soldiers that were really important early on. Let me just show you the sectors today. Yes, tech is moving, but the other two, essentially tech sectors, consumer discretionary. There's the Dow. We're just off of the highs. As you can see, S&P 500 was up more than 50 points. But tech, consumer discretionary, communication services, these are essentially tech-oriented sectors. Those are the market movers. Banks were up nicely early on, right at the open. They've fallen back and are underperforming the S&P. Energy also was outperforming earlier on. It, too, has now been underperforming, along with consumer staples and more defensive sectors like healthcare. So you see the breadth of the market is narrowing out a little bit. Instead, we're back to that old reliance on the mega-cap names. Yes, we have new highs on Amazon and Netflix and Microsoft and Apple today. And semiconductors also powering a number of them at new highs. The usual names, NVIDIA seems like every day new high. KLA 10 Core, semiconductor capital equipment stock, also new highs as well. Teradyne, new high. And those work from home names, but we see them every day on the new high list. eBay, for example, or Akamai, which does cloud computing. PayPal, Salesforce, another stock that's been hitting a new high on a fairly regular basis. And the other thing that I see that's out there is China stocks. It is quite remarkable to see representatives or mouthpieces for the Chinese government essentially trying to jawbone the markets higher and succeeding. Shanghai, two-year high, historic high on Alibaba and JD.com today. Guys, back to you.
Yeah, that was a monster move today. Bob, thank you so much, Bob Pisani. And markets here continue to defy expectations as we rally despite the spread of coronavirus, the mayor of Miami becoming the latest to roll back his city's reopening plans. And yet the Nasdaq hitting another all-time high today. Despite the rally, Goldman Sachs is lowering its GDP forecast, and Citi says stocks will go sideways for the next year. Joining me to talk more about all this, Jason Brady is CEO of Thornburg Investment Management, and Mark Smith is vice president and portfolio manager at UBS Financial Services. Welcome to both of you. And Mark, I'll just start with you. I mean, it almost seems as markets are rallying because of coronavirus if you look at the strength of the tech trade.
Yeah, I think that there's definitely some upside in the markets that we're seeing. But we're telling our clients at Connor Smith Group at UBS that you have to wait and see. Right now, we've got some big headline risk coming out. Right now, we got tens of millions of people out of work. I'm talking to my clients who own restaurants around the country. And after PPP runs out, they're going to start laying off employees. You've got second quarter numbers. We have had no guidance on that. So we're telling our clients that be prepared to be shocked and awed with second quarter numbers. And the last thing is the election. We don't know if the cheerleader in chief is going to be in the White House. And so a lot of people are trying to figure out what's that going to mean for their portfolios.
Absolutely. Jason, you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I think Mark just detailed a number of the risks. As you look at what's driving this market, it's certainly not that we have a global pandemic that's suddenly solved, although certainly there's some numbers that are better. I think, look, the Fed is Atlas, and it's got the world on its shoulders. And once you put the world on your shoulders, it's tough to put back down again. So what we're looking at is trying to create portfolios with balance. You've mentioned the China trade. This is really a global market. And the mouthpiece of the state that was really pushing stocks forward in China, you know, frankly, there's a lot of similarities here, too. So make sure folks have balance in their portfolios is what we're saying when we talk to clients.
Mark, let me go back to you because, you know, I guess what I'm wondering is tech so resilient because of everything that we're describing, right? When you have the spread of coronavirus, when you're talking about stay at home, when you're talking about long-term changes in the workforce, I mean, all of these really favor the biggest tech companies, even some of the risks that you're describing. I mean, do you really see anything on the horizon that disrupts the leadership?
Listen, tech has continued to outperform. And I can't say that a lot about other sectors. You look at energy, down 50%+ since March. And, you know, I own a Tesla Model S. I don't think I'm driving another car that drives on gas anymore. Got financials trying to make money. 0% interest rates. Not sure how they're going to do a good job at that. Airlines. None of my friends are traveling. Hospitality. Retail sector. There are a lot of sectors out there that have major issues, and tech is not one of them.
Yeah, and Jason, it reminds me of the reaction everybody had when we learned that Warren Buffett was selling the airlines a couple of months ago, as it seems like it was after a lot of the downward move on the back of coronavirus. But he and Charlie Munger have said, we don't know. We've never been through something like this pandemic. And even though we've seen a nice move off the bottom, I mean, what's going to happen to American Airlines? It's anybody's guess.
Exactly right. I mean, look, at Thornburg, we've been around since the early 80s, but 1918 was preceded that. So it's hard to guess exactly how this is going to roll through. What I'll say, though, is there are names out there looking at individual sectors and individual names where there is actually a more resilient earnings picture. I'll point to telecom services as part of that whole communication services sector, which is, you know, pretty value-based, pretty beaten-up sector from a price perspective. But actually, your earnings are doing pretty well as for all the reasons you can imagine. So I think when you drill down into this on a name-by-name basis, there are things to do. More broadly, though, yeah, it's a volatility, a volatile environment we're just going to have to continue to get used to for all the reasons that Mark mentioned at the top of this.
Yeah,
segment.
Well, we got to go. But, Mark, you did say something interesting about how a lot of your clients or some of your clients own restaurants and they're worried about, you know, the layoffs that they're facing. What would ameliorate that? Is it obviously a vaccine? You know, but I'm guessing maybe another round of PPP or something like that. I mean, is there anything else you see that could forestall them having to make those further staff reductions?
Yeah, unless there's another round of PPP coming out of Washington, they're going to have to make these layoffs. I've owned a restaurant and there's no way I could run a business at 75% capacity. Sometimes I lost money at 100% capacity.
Right.
So, you know, that is inherently the problem. Folks do not want to take the risk of possibly contracting this virus, even though it is a very small risk. The problem is, do you want to be the person who's in that category of folks that end up in the hospital? And most folks are just not willing to take it.
Of course not. Heck no. Most people would say. All right, gentlemen, thank you both. Appreciate the market thoughts, some of those personal anecdotes as well. Mark Smith, Jason Brady, it's been a pleasure today. Speaking of Warren Buffett, Berkshire Hathaway making its first major purchase in more than 4 years. It bought Dominion Energy's natural gas assets in a $10 billion deal. Brian Sullivan is here with more he's on the newsline. But Brian, we were curious about the timing of this deal, the significance of it, the fact that it's coming from Berkshire. Tell me everything that's on your mind.
Okay, well, that's a lot there. Hi, by the way, Kelly. Okay, so this is a big deal. I mean, listen, Warren Buffett will get the headlines, and as I sort of joked internally last night on email, I said, Uncle Warren wants to keep us warm, because a big purchase, part of this purchase, is these natural gas storage and transportation outlets that are being filled right now that will heat much of the Northeast in the wintertime. So that's a big part of it, recurring business, heavy cash flow, the kind of stuff Berkshire likes. And I say Berkshire, not Buffett, for this reason. Keep your eye on Greg Abel. Okay, Greg Abel is kind of a low-key guy. He is the head of Berkshire Energy. He is the vice chairman of the non-insurance part of Berkshire as well. This is him picking his head up, and we all talk about Berkshire's and Buffett's ultimately succession plan. You've got Todd Coombs. You've got a few others. Greg Abel now squarely in that mix, buying up these assets. Why now? Okay, I'll tell you why. Dominion Energy, who they bought from, and Duke were supposed to build this Atlantic Coast pipeline.
Right.
After 8 years, they have given up on it, Kelly. And guess what? They realize they need to get out of it. And who's available for a fast, all-cash purchase? Mr. Warren Buffett.
So it is directly tied to the pipeline deal falling through.
Absolutely. I talked to a guy last night, talked to a couple people last night. The pipeline industry as a whole is in trouble. Okay. There are lawsuits. It is capital intensive. You name it, it's an issue. And so I think what Buffett is seeing and Greg Abel and his team is seeing is this is our opportunity to pick up some assets from Dominion, which is a little bit financially stretched. Dominion would like to build a giant wind farm offshore in Virginia because their power customers want renewables. They can divest a, quote, older style asset, meaning fossil fuels, delever their balance sheet a bit. The market didn't like it, by the way. Look,
no,
at
we're down 10%, Bry.
Because, as I wrote to you and some others last night, it could be perceived by some as a credit negative type event. The Atlantic Coast Pipeline was a huge project. A lot of money was sunk into it already. It's not going to happen. So you're looking at a company, Berkshire, which, by the way, has a huge renewables business, wind farms, et cetera. But I think that, Greg and Warren and the team there at Berkshire, they're willing to step out of the ESG conversation, Kelly, obviously, a little bit, and buy into fossil fuels at a time when others are trying to divest. So think about classic Warren Buffett. Mm. Older industry, heavy cash flow, out of favor, and guess who steps in?
And in he comes. First big deal in 4 years. Great stuff, Brian. Thank you, sir. We appreciate it. Brian Sullivan explaining the deal, why the shares are down, and I should mention Berkshire shares are up a little under 2% today. Coming up after this quick break, another breakthrough in testing. Some good news from Becton Dickinson, which gets FDA approval for its new rapid COVID-19 test. It's portable and results are available in 15 minutes. We're going to speak with the CEO about this and how quickly they can manufacture the test as well as the cost. Plus, the NASDAQ hitting its 26th all-time high this year. Apple, Netflix, Microsoft, Amazon all soaring. In fact, Amazon shares passed $3,000 today. Can you still buy in? We've got some names. Stay with us.
This is The Exchange on CNBC.
Welcome back. Check out shares Regeneron up. What is that? About 1% right now. It's COVID-19 antibody drug cocktail moves into phase 3 trials. This is as case numbers continue to surge across the country. Meg Terrell is here now with all the latest news on this front. Meg?
Hey, Kelly. Well, this Regeneron news that its antibody drug designed to treat COVID-19 is moving into late stage clinical trials comes less than a month after they began the first phase of human clinical trials. So just an amazing pace. And what they're doing here is looking at this drug both for prevention and for treatment. So they're beginning a phase 3 prevention trial in uninfected people who've come into close contact with somebody with COVID-19. That'll be in collaboration with the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. So testing it in people like housemates of patients, for example. They're also going to be running late stage trials, or they're already in those, to treat patients both in the hospital and who are not hospitalized with COVID-19. They say those data are expected later this summer. This is based basically on about 30 patients in the early stages of clinical trials getting the go ahead, at least on the safety of those. We have not yet seen those data, so we'll be eagerly awaiting it. And Kelly, this of course comes as case numbers continue to rise, hitting several records over the holiday weekend. Several days of more than 50,000 cases reported across the United States. This data here from the COVID tracking project, you can see hospitalizations in the country as a whole are now ticking up, whereas the daily numbers of deaths are still declining. Experts say they expect that could follow hospitalizations in ticking up with some lag time. Now, in terms of the states reporting the most cases, Florida continues to break more than 10,000, although it had a lower number today. You often see among Mondays and after holiday weekends, lower numbers of tests and of cases, Kelly.
At least temporarily. Meg, thank you so much. We appreciate it. Meg Terrell with the very, very latest there. And now to a positive development in the COVID fight. On the testing front, Becton Dickinson just received FDA approval for emergency use of its rapid antigen test for coronavirus. Now, this can produce results in 15 minutes, and it's portable, just slightly bigger than an iPhone. Joining me first on CNBC with details is Tom Poland, the president and CEO of Becton Dickinson. Welcome. It's good to have you.
Thank you, Kelly. Thanks for having me.
So tell me what an antigen test is and how it's different from other types of tests on the market.
Yeah, Kelly, so as you just mentioned earlier, there's certainly a growing need for tests. We see public health experts agree that testing has a critical role to help mitigate the spread that we're seeing now in new locations across the U.S. And for that testing to work, preferably it's going to be more accessible and more real-time, which is what antigen testing allows. Our Veritor platform, as you mentioned, is a handheld device. It's about a little larger than the size of a cell phone, with results in about 15 minutes, a highly portable instrument, and we think it can be a real game changer for COVID-19 diagnostics to help expand testing, again, in 15 minutes into communities right on the front line so that people can be more informed and better prepared to help prevent those new spikes and additional waves of COVID-19 by enabling healthcare workers to quickly diagnose patients, quarantine those individuals, and trace their contacts.
Would you liken this to the flu test that we are all used to getting, you know, with urgent care at your doctor's office, that type of experience?
It is the exact same. So we actually have about 25,000 Veritor instruments already located in all 50 states in the U.S., and we're one of the leaders in flu testing and strep tests. That the kids believe they have strep throat, it typically would get tested on a device like Veritor. We sell strep tests on the same instrument, and so we're adding this test for COVID-19 to that exact same platform that people are used to getting flu and strep throat tested.
So there will be definitely a level of familiarity. You're the second mover to this space, Quidel, first to come here. In fact, I believe the CEO said, you know, we need another player here. There's so much demand that we can barely keep up with it. Is there capacity for both of you to basically get in here and give this market as many tests as it can possibly demand? And if so, how do you think that will change the nature of how we're able to track the spread of coronavirus around this country?
Certainly the availability of a 15-minute test for the front line in healthcare clinics and doctor's offices and urgent care centers, retail pharmacy clinics, having millions of tests available there in essentially real time, we think will have a tremendous impact in helping to stop the spread and also potentially help to reopen the economy. We believe that there's going to be significant demand for both providers of these tests. We're expecting to produce over 10 million tests, or about 10 million tests, from July through September, and then as of the end of September, be producing about 2 million tests per week here. So really ramping up our production to help meet the need.
Your shares are up about 3% on the news today. $20 or so, is that what we should, kind of roughly estimate these tests will cost providers?
Yeah, to democratize testing and to put it in the hands of the frontline workers around the country, it needs to be affordable. And so actually, if you think about this versus molecular tests, think about a molecular platform. The instrument itself costs tens of thousands of dollars or over $100,000 very often. This instrument on the Veritor is several hundred dollars, very inexpensive, and the cost per test is about half the price of a molecular test, a little over $20 a test. So
final
to our healthcare.
Absolutely. Final quick question, Tom, before we go. Do you recommend that people who get this test have it confirmed by a molecular test?
That is, if it's negative and you have symptoms, it is the claim that you can have that confirmed via, you should have that confirmed via molecular test, yes. For all antigen tests, that would be the case.
Okay.
Same thing for flu testing, by the way. That's also the claim for flu.
Yeah, no, it's fascinating the way you're able to kind of take one platform, use it in this case, and hopefully help people know much more about what's going on. Tom Pollan, thank you so much for your time today.
Okay, thank you, Kelly.
Here with the news about their COVID testing breakthrough, he is the CEO of Becton Dickinson. Coming up, mortgage bailout numbers seeing their largest weekly decline yet, but there are some other red flags that could signal trouble ahead for housing. We have the latest. Plus, we're going yield hunting, a look at some stocks with strong buys on Wall Street and a higher dividend than the overall market. And remember, you can always watch or listen to us live on the go on the CNBC app. The Exchange is back in a couple. Welcome back to The Exchange on what's a banner day for the market so far to kick off the week. Dow was up 469 at the highs. They're square. We'll talk about that in a minute. But it's not just the Dow that's higher. It's also the S&P and the NASDAQ. In fact, the NASDAQ hitting another all-time high today. And you have the NASDAQ 100. That's a QQQ. It's one of the heaviest traded ETFs out there, up 20%, if you can believe it, on the year. So as you might have guessed, here's what's going on with the sectors. Technology technically third place on the leaderboard today, up 1.7%. But consumer tech, as you might think about it, which comes up in communication services and consumer discretionary, those are also up. In the case of 1.75 to about 2.3%. Only one sector is in the red today. That's utilities, down 1.4%. And in terms of some of the movers this hour, we are talking about Square. It's sharply higher today on a price target increase at SunTrust to 150 from 83, so a pretty big move there. That bank saying the pandemic has been a catalyst to cash apps and that Square is poised to take meaningful direct deposit share from banks, which is interesting. Square's around 100 121 on that 7% move today. Shares of Harley-Davidson hog higher after Citi started coverage of the stock with a buy rating. They cite an attractive valuation. Also, the potential for significant turnaround under the new CEO. The stock is down 33% so far this year, getting a 6% fill-up today, just under 25 a share. And finally, shares of Spotify are lower on that downgrade over at Bernstein. The bank saying while podcasts could increase Spotify's market share, it won't add much to the bottom line. Still, the shares, which have been a monster this year, only taken off about 4% of that gain today. And now to Sue Herrera for our CNBC News update. Sue?
Thank you very much, Kelly. Hello, everyone. Here's what's happening at this hour. Ghislaine Maxwell, who was accused of enticing minors to engage in illegal sex acts, has been transported to New York City, but isn't being housed at the same federal jail where her alleged accomplice, Jeffrey Epstein, took his own life last August. Her bail hearing will be held on Friday. Chinese health officials confirming a herdsman in the country's Inner Mongolian region has been infected with the bubonic plague. The man is currently in stable condition, and receiving treatment at a hospital. Local city officials are warning against hunting, eating, or transporting animals in that area. And Twitter is joining Facebook and WhatsApp in suspending all data information requests from Hong Kong authorities in light of China's controversial national security law. ESPN Films is gearing up to produce a docu-series on the life of activist and former NFL quarterback Colin Kaepernick as part of a production deal with Disney. You are up to date, Kel. That's the news update this hour. I'll send it back to you.
All right, Sue, thank you very much, Sue Herrera. The mortgage bailout numbers just saw their largest weekly decline yet, but the headline doesn't tell the full story about the health of housing right now. Diana Olick is here to explain. Diana?
Yeah, Kelly, the overall numbers are falling, but more borrowers are now extending their bailouts. As of June 30th, 4.58 million homeowners were in forbearance plans. That's according to Black Knight. And that's 8.6% of all active mortgages, down by about 100,000 in just the past week, but there's a big red flag. The federal mortgage bailout started at the end of March, initially as a 90-day plan with the option to extend to 6 months. And that's the flag. More than 2 million borrowers got in right in those first 2 weeks and so would be expiring about now. And more borrowers are extending than exiting their bailouts. You can see it here. In the last 2 weeks, the share of extended bailouts past 90 days jumped from 10% of all forbearances to over 17%. And that's according to the Mortgage Bankers Association, which breaks down these numbers. Now, as extra unemployment benefits expire and parts of the economy may de-open due to rising COVID cases, these extensions are likely to rise, Kelly.
Yeah, de-open. What do we call it when you stop the reopening? I guess it is a de-open. Diana, thank you very much. We appreciate it. Diana Olick with the housing latest. Consolidation in the money-losing food delivery space. The Manhattan real estate market is frozen, and Elon Musk is taunting the shorts again. It's all coming up in today's edition of Rapid Fire right after this. Welcome back. Let's catch you up on a few stories that should be on your radar today. It is time for Rapid Fire. And here to break down the headlines are Eric Chemmy, Leslie Picker, and Robert Frank. Welcome, everybody. First up, Uber is buying food delivery service Postmates in a $2.65 billion all-stock deal. And so we add our fourth, Deirdre Bosa, for some of the details on this one. Deirdre, everyone wants to know what's it mean for DoorDash and the rest of the players.
Yeah, that's a good question, Kelly. Well, so Uber getting Postmates, remember just a few weeks ago, it lost out on Grubhub, and everyone in this space has been talking about consolidation for the last few years, really. So the big question, is it winner take all, or can there be a few players that exist? Uber and Grubhub would have merged two of the bigger players in this space. Postmates is relatively small, and you know, some insiders say that this doesn't actually give Uber a ton. It gives them the lead in some important markets like LA and Miami, but it's still going to be very difficult to compete with the dominant player, and that's DoorDash. One of the most interesting things that I've read throughout the last few weeks is that DoorDash's market cap went from just about 18% a few years ago to now 45%. So this is a company that has been focused on food delivery and logistics. Uber has been focused on ride sharing and moonshot projects. So it's now trying to catch up. Big question whether Postmates will do that for
them. And that's a big market share boost from 18 to 45%. Robert, you know, when David Faber was reporting on the Grubhub deal that ultimately went to the European company, he said, you know, the good thing about this for consumers is it probably means better prices, lower prices, because now they have backing. It's not consolidating the number of players. Does anything about the Uber Postmates deal, you think, put that in jeopardy, mean higher prices for us?
Not immediately. In fact, I think the problem is the opposite. There was just way too much competition in this space. It's a money-losing business for most of the players, as Deirdre just said. And the price that Uber is paying for this is massive, and they're going to need to recoup that. And it's unlikely they're going to do it through price increases, more likely through market share. So I don't see big prices for consumers anytime soon. I do see more losses for these companies.
Leslie, would you agree on that front? I mean, because when they've got deep backing for now, we know that that can go on for some time.
I think part of the impetus behind the consolidation was this idea that if there are fewer players, then they could potentially charge higher fees, generate more revenue from these businesses. I mean, that's been the big issue with all of the competition. It's the issue that we're seeing with ride sharing as well. So, you know, if you've ordered from Postmates lately, we did so this past weekend, I think we paid $16 in fees, and that did not include delivery.
Right.
So the fees are already pretty steep. You have to wonder if combining the two businesses together, what that means for the delivery fees moving forward, what that means for the economics for, you know, all of the various players
yeah.
with these businesses, the you know, the restaurants, the consumer, the delivery people. So it'll be interesting to see.
I know. We think we all know they're going up. I mean, it's a lot already, but it's probably going up. Deirdre, thank you. We'll see you later. Deirdre Bosa. Want to talk about the Treasury Department and the Small Business Administration releasing a partial list today of companies that received loans of more than $150,000 as part of the Paycheck Protection Program. So many different names, guys, on this list. Everything from P.F. Chang's and Chopped and Famous Dave's to Archdiocese of New York and San Francisco, the Girl Scouts of America, David Boies Law Firm, Serena and Lily. And Eric, this caught my eye. Big Three Basketball and USA Basketball. What do you think they're going to do with the funds for, you know, we'll talk more about the sports in a second, but this is such an eclectic list of companies. It just tells me there's so many, everybody's affected by COVID.
Well, I mean, this is why you look back in 2008 when they had all the bank money that they were giving out, and they said all the banks are going to take the money, so that way no one's going to get singled out.
Hmm.
So now that we're singling out all these companies, a lot of them probably didn't think about that 3, 4, 5 months ago. I don't think any of us thought about that. Oh, I would get singled out. Maybe it's not worth the PR. It's a tricky one because obviously you can't give money to every single business. And if you've got a banking relationship with somebody and they just go ahead and get this going for you,
right,
whose fault is it? And look, these companies that can have big brand names, I'm not saying in any particular case what's right or wrong, but all these companies, they employ people. And
mm-hmm.
a lot of these people that are employed, they have regular salaries. And as you and I know, a lot of people that work in, let's say, pro sports, they have modest incomes. And if those games don't happen, they're out of a job, they're not paying their rent. So just because these things have good brand names doesn't mean they're not worthwhile places to put these loans at.
No, I think that's absolutely true. And Leslie, we turn to you and then to Robert, because there are some names you know people are going to zero in on and say, well, wait a minute, is that fair? You're looking at some of the companies with private equity backing.
Mm-hmm.
Robert, we see, you know, private jet companies pop up and that sort of thing. Leslie, what to you is the message from some of the PE-backed names that have applied for and received help here?
So far, we've seen quite a few names that are backed by at least venture capital, private equity, growth funds. We're still going through the list of 700,000 names to give a more complete picture. But I think one thing that, you know, private equity firms would say is that, yes, we have trillions of dollars of cash on the sidelines, but that doesn't necessarily mean we can use that cash. That doesn't mean our LPs give us the liberty to use that cash to make sure that our portfolio companies are able to keep staff employed at those respective companies. And so I think, they have definitely come under fire politically as,
yeah.
you know, utilizing this program. It was structured so that they didn't. There are definitely workarounds. There are tons of companies that pursued those workarounds. And it's just interesting to see kind of how that all is shaping up.
And Robert, I think it's a tension between people who say, well, I thought this was meant for small businesses. And what about companies, whether it's a sports team, whether it's Gore's VTAC Holdings, you know, any Newsday, right? They say, what about companies that are owned by billionaires? Should those billionaires be personally on the hook or able to continue funding them, or should they turn to the government for help? That's where a lot of this is coming back to.
Absolutely. There are two questions with this list. The first is, did these companies do anything wrong? The answer is absolutely not. They applied to the program. They followed the rules. The rules were, at the time, very loose. They didn't say you had to have an alternate source of funding. And the proof for whether you were impacted by COVID was very loose. So all these companies, just by singling them out, we're not saying they did anything wrong. But the second piece is, as a taxpayer, is this where you want your money to go? And I think that's the question we're going to be asking, whether it's Newsday, which is owned by the billionaire Dolan family, or some of these other companies that are also owned by people who have massive amounts of capital they themselves could have put in the business. And are these the types of businesses, whether you're talking about archdiocese or these other types of businesses, is this where taxpayer money should go? And I think that's going to be the debate from this list.
Is there anything else that you think, Robert, we're going to learn? So it is an interesting point that would anybody have taken the money knowing this was going to be made public? And if there is another round of PPP, as we were just talking about at the start of the program, if people end up needing more, are people, I mean, we didn't even tap the rest of the existing fund right now. I mean, there seems to be a sense of, you know, tread very carefully if you're stepping up to the plate here.
Yeah, this list does not include companies and billionaires who gave the money back. So those people got removed from the list once they saw the backlash. So companies like Nikola, the big electric trunk company, all these other publicly traded companies that gave the money back, they are not on the list. And I think going forward, a reason that companies are not taking all this leftover money is because now that they learned it's going to go public and they learned there's all these other strings attached, they just didn't want the money. So I think it's going to be tough to give away the rest of this money because of the transparency and because of all the new strings attached to borrowing this money or just taking it.
No, it's tricky. Again, going back to what Eric was saying, you want everybody whose job is at risk. You know, it's not their fault, but again, it's becoming so political. All right, we got to move on. Speaking of political, a pair of pro sports teams are examining their names amid growing calls for racial justice across the country. The NFL team based in Washington, D.C., says it's undergoing a thorough review of its name, while Major League Baseball's team based in Cleveland says it's working to determine its best path forward. I mean, Eric, if we can't even say the names, it's over, right? I mean, how many more college and pro teams do you think are going to see name changes? And that's not a very easy thing to pull off, but I suppose that's the least of their concerns.
I mean,
right,
pulling
now
it off, look, it's just a matter of the money lost in terms of jerseys you can't sell, sponsors that might get upset because they built out all this inventory. That doesn't really matter. You want to pull it off, you can change the name of your company, your team, your logo. You can change it tomorrow as long as you can get the trademark and make sure you're not confusing it with someone else's business or their trademark. So, look, in the case of Washington, they can change that name with league approval. They could literally change it this week if they want and have new jerseys ready to go by opening day, assuming games are being played in September. So timing and cost, not that big of a deal. It's just a question of how far does this go. You've already seen high school teams changing their names. This could go all across the country, depending on how far this gets pushed.
And Leslie, I thought it was interesting in the Redskins case that the investment partners, some of the minority owners of the team, were among those pushing for change. Now, we're used to seeing, you know, calls on Twitter and sort of, you know, GoFundMe campaigns. But I wonder, as the ESG movement grows, if we're going to see more of this coming from the investment world.
That's an important point, Kelly. And I think that those investors also have reputational risk here, right? It becomes an issue for them. It becomes an issue for them and their various counterparties if they're, you know, associated with an entity that, you know, the majority of people, I'm not saying that they do, but the majority of people may find offensive. And interestingly, I was at the University of Illinois when we got rid of our mascot, Chief Illiniwek, which, you know, a lot of people found offensive. And I would say, you know, 15 years later, it kind of just, everyone moves on and kind of gets used to it. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with these teams that certainly have a lot of money behind them and a lot of support to change the name.
And Robert, you're a Binghamton guy. I mean, I grew up outside Syracuse. We had the orange, you know, the Syracuse orange. That was 40
like
years
Leslie
ago.
Like Leslie said, we had the Colonials. They were got rid of shortly after I graduated, and now it's the Bearcats. I don't even know what a Bearcat is, but hopefully it's politically correct, at least for now. But yeah, like Leslie said, after a while, you don't even notice.
Yeah, and
you just forget.
Yeah, whether Washington is next, I think, is for next month to decide. Finally, just want to mention this kind of a fun one. Elon Musk always comes up with something new. He's following through on his tweet about offering short shorts for Tesla short sellers by actually offering them. The limited edition garment is already sold out in all sizes, has the Tesla logo on the front and S3XY written on the back. Guys, Tesla shares hit another all-time high today. They're over $1,300. There you can see it. They're up nearly 10% again. Mr. Frank, give me some thoughts.
I don't know why they didn't make more. I mean, everything this guy touches turns to gold and red and satin. So I just don't understand why he sold a limited amount. I mean, he could just, you know, sell thousands, millions of these things if he really wanted to.
Yeah, the flamethrowers, the shorts. Go ahead, Leslie.
David Einhorn got a bunch of shorts for free. So if you're a short seller, apparently, you know, you get them sent to you.
Do you know
this was back in 2018? But
Jim Chanos, Leslie, I think, is still short Tesla.
Yeah, I haven't heard any differently. So I don't know if he'll be getting a special satin red pair of shorts, but you know, certainly is incentivizing short sellers, if you ask me.
Maybe with his name embroidered on it. We'll leave it there before we go any further. Thank you all today. We appreciate it. Eric Chemie, Leslie Picker, and Robert Frank. Still ahead, despite Congress extending the PPP deadline, a key economic indicator suggests layoffs could soon pick up as the first round of that money wears off. That's coming up next on The Exchange. Welcome back to The Exchange. Let's go yield hunting. CNBC and S&P Global Market Intelligence ran a screen to find stocks that are rated a strong buy by equity analysts and offer a dividend yield higher than the overall markets. Here are some of the top picks. Coca-Cola and Pepsi both making the list. Coke edges out Pepsi with a yield of 3.6%. The stock is still down about 18% this year. Over in tech, the street likes Broadcom, which pays a hefty 4% dividend. That stock also relatively flat on the year. Over in energy, PPL offers a dividend of nearly 6.5%, although it's been a rough year for the name, down 28%. For more of the names, you can visit cnbc.com/pro. Meanwhile, exactly 120 days stand between now and Election Day. Democratic candidate Joe Biden's surge in the polls has Wall Street bracing for a potential corporate tax reversal, among other things. But J.P. Morgan is out with the contrarian view today that unlike the consensus that a Democratic victory in November would be a negative for the markets, they see it as neutral to slightly positive. Joining me to discuss the latest D.C. developments, Dan Clifton is head of policy research at Strategus Research Partners. Dan, it's good to see you again. Your take on the fall is a little bit different, right?
That's right. I mean, we're going to be approaching the 120-day mark. This is really the beginning of the campaign, Kelly. This is exactly where Donald Trump started making his move on Hillary Clinton 4 years ago, and I think we're at the beginning of the campaign. It will start with the vice president making his vice president selection, then you'll have the two conventions. But clearly the president is way behind at this point. This is a referendum on his first 4 years in office. Unemployment's up. COVID response is not good. He's facing significant headwinds. So investors are starting to look at the election and saying, okay, what could happen? Well, Biden is the favorite at this point. What stocks could be impacted by regulatory factors where you don't need to know what's going to happen with Congress? Those are the first stocks starting to move. And then as we get into the fall and investors can better handicap what's going to happen on the Senate, I think you'll start to see some real activity around the sectors themselves. But
yeah.
Kelly, just to be clear, the S&P 500 has predicted every presidential election winner since 1984 and 87% of winners since 1928. And it's really about the performance of stocks in the 90-day period before the election. Stocks are higher, the incumbent party wins. Stocks are lower, the opposition party wins. It's not perfect. It's 87% of the time. But that tells you that the equity market really doesn't begin to focus on this until the first week of August, once we get out of earnings season.
Fair enough. There's something in here about biotech that caught my eye. And you think that, you know, the narrative has been biotech is going to come to the rescue on COVID. Therefore, you know, regulators are going to get off their back over drug pricing. We remember the famous Hillary tweet that sent the whole sector down, and it's kind of still cast a pall over it. But you're saying rethink that conventional wisdom that you see the market telling investors that biotech regulatory risk is going to be there.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So you got to think about this in the near term, and then you got to look at it next year. In the near term, the president doesn't seem very interested in any type of regulatory initiatives on drug prices after years of saying he was going to go after. That may change if he's losing with seniors. But consider this. Right now, there's going to be a lot of buyouts. There's no buybacks going on. So there's going to probably be a lot of M&A ahead of a capital gains tax increase in that sector. But once we get to 2021, I think it would be impossible for the Democrats not to do something on drug pricing within an overall health care bill that they're going to do to try and expand the ACA. So if you're an investor and you're looking at health care and the Democrats are going to sweep, there's probably going to be more risk to biotech than there is today. And at the same time, there's probably going to be less risk than the consensus expects around the Affordable Care Act stocks, Medicaid HMOs, hospitals, equipment makers. Yeah. And so you can probably see them catch a bid in early 2021. Pharma seems to have some real headwinds with the Democrats.
One more kind of more near-term issue, it's extremely pertinent. We've kind of been discussing it all hour, Dan, is what happens when the first round of PPP money runs out. The fact that all of these names are being released today suggests people are going to be really loath to get involved with any future program, even if there is one. What's going to happen with that and its impact for the economy?
Kelly, I absolutely agree. The companies have been shamed for taking that money, but this program has saved 40 million American jobs during a pandemic. It should be rewarded and applauded, and it's not. But that program expires on August 8th. I think there's going to be a refinement of that. We probably have another $1 trillion stimulus that's going to pass in the next 30 days ahead of this election, as both parties really do need to start filling in the blanks for Republicans, small business aid, for Democrats, state and local government aid. That will form the consensus there. And then really the hard issue will be getting a deal on unemployment insurance reform as part of that. But I do believe the will is there to get a deal in 30 to 45 days on the stimulus package.
So do you think that will keep us from seeing the worst consequences of that kind of PPP cliff as a result?
That's correct, right? So we already have about $100 billion left over on PPP. We're going to refine it. We're going to retarget it. And the income cliff on unemployment insurance, where that $600 a week benefit goes down. You'll probably see it crammed down a little bit, where it won't be as generous because the worst part of the pandemic is over. But you are going to see continued support for this economy from both parties ahead of their election. And while the president may benefit from that stimulus, you got to remember 535 members of both parties are up for vote in November, whether that's in the House or most of the 535. And so there's going to be a will to get something done from both parties.
Yeah, that's for sure. Dan, we appreciate it. Thank you, sir.
Great. Thank you.
Dan Clifton of Strategus with all the latest. Coming up, with the Nasdaq posting yet another record high today, tech continues to dominate the market's gains. So which names in the sector should you own going into the second half of the year? That's next. Welcome back to The Exchange. Tech continues to dominate the market. Check out the Nasdaq 100. It continues to smash records and hit its 26th all-time high this year. It's up about 20% year-to-date. Now, the index is also up 50% since the March lows. Just an incredible performance. But if the momentum continues, which names should you own going into the back half of the year? Joining me now is James Chuckmuck. He's partner at Clockwise Capital. James, it's good to see you. And do you stick with the winners or go for some of the lesser-loved plays in tech right now?
I think a little bit of both, but the first thing I'd say is we're going through a revolution right now. You know, when you look back at the history of tech, you have the industrial revolution to the telecom to the digital, and now what we see is the productivity slash time savings revolution. So these things are inevitable. But what's happening is, and I think what's so head spinning, is that this revolution is taking place at a breakneck speeds in a way that we've never seen before as technology has been pulled forward. So when you talk about NASDAQ reaching new highs and these big tech companies at 30% or so of the S&P, I think it's less about a sector being too overweight versus a realization about how big this disruption really is.
So give me some of your favorite companies.
Yeah, so we think tech is bifurcated into two. You know, first you have the essential infrastructure services. We continue to be long Amazon, Apple, and Facebook, though we did trim shares on Facebook and Apple, but still gung-ho on Amazon. And on the new tech side, the companies that are actually leveraging and providing that productivity benefits, we like Slack, we like Square, and Spotify.
It's interesting you say productivity and time saving, because a lot of people feel like they're wasting their time with all these different messaging apps, and they're sitting on one Zoom call after another. Just kind of summarize that if you can, and also give us a sense for, you know, how much room these names might have to run.
I think, a tremendous amount of room. I mean, you look at these companies. You know, a company like Slack is disrupting the way communication happens from the early stages of a company to a later stage. You have a company like Spotify that's completely transforming how you access audio and how you monetize audio. And Square is doing similar things on the data front, on the small business front. So what we think about time savings and productivity is how can we lead to, which companies can lead to a step function change in terms of how quickly we can deploy assets and how quickly we can translate those time savings into other avenues of our business. So we don't really think about work from home per se. It's more about which companies are disrupting the entire old paradigm in terms of how we operate.
Let's spend one extra moment on Spotify, which got a downgrade today because the analyst was concerned they don't monetize podcasts as well as they do music. And that's clearly where they're betting their future.
Yeah, I mean, look, we've done well on the stock over the last couple of months, but the fact of the matter is we think it has, the hope has gotten slightly ahead of where the monetization prospects lie. You know, we think this is a 3 to 5 year play. A lot of hope and optimism has been built in with the big name deals that they've had. But when you think about how do you monetize audio, how do you do it in a scaled way, in a way that's really unrivaled, within the market, we think that there's tremendous opportunity from here. But yeah, I mean, near term, it's not going to be something that's going to be a massive uptick on the next quarter.
And tell me about Amazon, where we crossed $3,000 today. How much are you trimming?
We're not trimming Amazon. We trimmed Apple and we trimmed Facebook because we think cash is an asset that's not really thought about as much because there is going to be volatility in the market. We have no idea what's going to happen when the timing of the stimulus ends and whatnot, what happens with the election. So you need to be able to deploy that cash. So we are sitting at about 20% cash right now. As it relates to Amazon, you know, we think that people are you have to understand that there's 6 different businesses in one. And at the end of the day, this could very well conceivably be a $2 trillion company and the first one to hit it. So you're looking at a price target of north of $4,000.
Yeah, that hardly seems unreasonable after the year that they've had. James, thank you so much. It's great to see you. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
James Chuckmuck with some tech plays for the back half of 2020. That does it for us today. Thanks for tuning in.
You've been listening to The Exchange. Make sure you're subscribed to get each episode every day, same time, same place.